welcome, friends. We are glad, as always, that you've joined us for another Basic Conversation. Father Basic, I think we have a heavy hitter to talk about today, Thomas Merton.
Yes, I've heard of him.
So what can you give us as far as background on this great mind?
Yeah, what is important about it? He lived in New York City and was a good life living there, enjoyed the city and its interactions and so on. Eventually, he studied at Cambridge for a while. Those of us from Oxford called that the other place. He studied at that other place. He didn't take it seriously. He messed up his life there and had some bad things happen and so on. Came back to the United States and went to Columbia. Eventually did get a degree there and taught at St. Bonaventure in Olean, New York. Well, that was an important part. And then he decides that he's going to become Catholic. And a surprise to his friends and so on. And he did that, was converted, took on the Catholic faith in a serious way, eventually decided that he wanted to be a monk. Went to Gethsemane in Cincinnati and in Kentucky, the monastery there, and that's where he lived the rest of his life. He lived a life very different from what ordinary Catholic people live. In other words, he's in a monastery. He gets up early and says prayers and prayers at night. There's a regular routine. They have a lot of silence and so on. So it's a life very different from what most Catholics are living. And yet he became popular, which is sort of mysterious in itself. In other words, he ended up, after he went in the monastery, he wrote a book called Seven Story Mountain, which became a New York Times bestseller for weeks and weeks, long time. It was a story of his conversion to Catholicism and what brought him to that. And so he wrote on that for a long time. He essentially lived his life in the monastery. Periodically, he traveled. He had a lot of conflicts with his abbot, Abbot Fox. It's probably worth at least looking at that a little bit. So Merton, as he grew in fame, was often invited to conferences, and he wanted to go to them and so on. And Dom Fox often wouldn't let him go.
And the reason being?
Hard to know. It depends on who you ask.
You're supposed to be a monk and be humble and not be known.
Exactly.
Got it.
Yeah. A famous entry in his diary where he wanted to go to a liturgical conference with the Benedictines, and Dom Fox said, no, you can't go. And Merton tells the story of how that went down with him. And you can see him back and forth as well. I did make a vow of obedience, you know, but he's being selfish. He's worried about himself. And then Dom Fox gave a sermon in which Merton was convinced. He was talking about don't be too prideful and don't get carried away with yourself and be obedient and so on. Merton thought that, well, he's talking about me. And he confronted Dom Fox and said that. And the abbot said to him, I wasn't talking about you. And Merton plays with that and says, I don't really believe him. So what you see is the play of his mind. He says, I'm supposed to be a monk. I'm supposed to be obedient. I shouldn't be traveling all around. And yet here I am. Honestly, I did want to go. Oh, no, I really didn't want to go. So he's writing this in his diary. You're getting a sense of his mind, of how he's struggling with his own emotions and so on. And his final word in that entry was, Fox, I wasn't talking about you and so on in my sermon. And Merton's last line is, "I don't believe him." So, I mean, it tells you, I mean, Dom Fox was not nice to Merton. I mean, it was, he once sent him off to a psychiatrist, and he was planted. Fox wanted the psychiatrist. He told the psychiatrist to tell Merton that he shouldn't, he should be more obedient and so on. And so he sends him to this psychiatrist, and Merton doesn't know he's being set up. And the psychiatrist didn't tell him, "You're too prideful. You're an exhibitionist. You might as well set up your hermitage on Times Square in New York." And Merton was just hit by this and so on, and had to adjust to that. So that the life in the monastery wasn't always easy.
Did he ever think about leaving the monastery?
Because you know, it's hard to tell. He has said no. There were always rumors that he was going to become a Buddhist or go elsewhere. Merton, my own sense is that he never thought of leaving. I mean, it brings up he had a long-standing relationship with a nurse that took care of him in a hospital in Louisville, and it was a very strong relationship, and Abbot Fox eventually cut it off. There's an interesting line. When Merton entered the monastery, he says he went in and they closed the doors behind him and he was imprisoned in his new freedom. He was imprisoned in his new freedom. My own sense is that he knew he had such a volatile psyche and interest and libido, and he was just a passionate man. And it's as though he knew he needed to regulate it somehow, that he knew. In fact, I believe he made sure that Abbot Fox heard about his relationship with the nurse in Louisville, and he did it on purpose so that Fox would tell him to break it off.
Wasn't that when he got ill? When Merton got ill and the nurse was taking care of him?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. That was a famous event on the corner of Walnut and Fifth in Louisville, when he had this deep experience of his unity with all the people there. He felt one, united, totally united with the people walking with him, going across the street with him and so on. It was one of his deep religious experiences. But what's practical for people? I know a man, a businessman right now, who's just into Merton. He's traveling around. He went down to Gethsemane to see where he was. He's traveling to the places where Merton lived for a while. And he's just taken with him, thrilled with him. So he's still of interest to people. Practically, what I would say is that one thing he told us is, find your own path to greatness, to holiness. Don't follow somebody else. You must learn to trust your own experience. You must find how to pray. You must find how to respond to God, how to be more attentive to the Spirit. And when he was often asked, "Well, I want your advice on how to pray," and he would not say, he wouldn't tell anybody. He never did. One of the lines, though, that he did tell people that comes to me is, to try to pray is already to pray. Mm-hmm. I have shared that with many people. You know, people say, "Oh, I'm trying. I don't feel anything. I don't sense God's presence. I don't hear any messages from the Spirit. I don't get really deeply excited spiritually," and so on. And to try to pray is already to pray. That helps many of us who don't find satisfaction in prayer, don't feel like we're heard, don't feel like God is listening to us. Reminds me of Rahner's thing, "Encounters with Silence." Encounters, I'm praying, I don't hear anything back. So he's very helpful to people that way, it seems to me, that. So what that would suggest for us, well, let's find, how are we going to improve as prayers then? We're going to try. That's number one. Just give it a try. Do whatever. And then let's try to find the best time to pray. So somebody might say, well, I try to pray at night and I fall asleep every night. You know, so maybe what that person wants to do is pray in the morning. So finding our best time would be good. Finding a routine that works for us. So somebody might say, yeah, I'm going to meditate 15 minutes, 20 minutes, a half hour every day in the next month. And then on the third day, they're too busy and they can't do it. So one way to think of it is to find, we need a routine. Having a routine is good. But we have to be able to do it regularly, mostly, periodically. It's like exercise. Someone says, yeah, I want to exercise every day, but I only do it on nice days when I can walk outside. No exercise on a lot of days. So we have to find a time when we actually are better prepared to pray. It might be morning, afternoon, night, whatever works best for us. The other thing to find is a place to pray. Where can we pray? So for many families, it's hard to pray at any time during the day because you're raising kids. You got to get to the store. We got to get kids to soccer practice and so on. I mean, when are we going to be able to pray? One woman goes to the bathroom to pray, and so she can be away for a while and from the great responsibilities of motherhood and raising kids. So finding a place. I mean, some people find out if they kneel down, they pray better. Other people say, well, if I kneel down, my knees hurt, and I'm more worried about the arthritis in my knees than I am about praying. So we want to find a place that would work for us, that where we can be alone. Or maybe somebody in the family says, you know, husband tells us, you know, I need some space right now, you know. I feel a need to try to calm down and feel God's presence. You know, I'm going to go off to the side for a while and in another room. So finding our own way to make the journey of life. We're all on a journey, but it's a unique journey. And Merton was really big on it. Find your own way. You know, I'm not going to tell you how to do it. So... does that sound practical?
Yes, I mean, very much so. Well, there's a lot of practical insights and perspective from his autobiography too, right? The Seven Story Mountain.
Yeah, he was never very proud of Seven Story Mountain. No. Afterwards. It was a big bestseller. He thought it was self-serving, that it was isolationist, that it was triumphalistic. He was critical of his own work. And I think properly so. I mean, if we would read that now and from the viewpoint of people steeped in the Second Vatican Council, there's a lot of nuance and direction and that doesn't sound all that right. So it was very self-serving and very opinionated, very one way. It wasn't very open to other things, which brings up maybe another thing that Merton learned as he went along in his own life. He became much more open and dialogic and willing to learn from others. I would say, in my own mind, I see sort of two different directions with that, if I can keep them straight. You know, one is, he wrote a book called Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander. Conjectures, he's thinking about himself as a guilty bystander. What did he mean by that? Well, he's in the monastery and he's doing his praying And eventually he moved to a hermitage underground where he could live totally by himself and away from people and so on and commune with nature. But it wasn't connected in with the great causes of the times. This is in the 60s he's talking about. And so what he began to see is that love of God has to include love of neighbor. If you don't love, if you say you love God, you're praying all the time and so on, but you're not doing anything to help your neighbor, you're living a deceitful life. You're a guilty bystander. And so he writes this book, and indeed it changed his behavior and his outlook. He became very passionate about racial justice, about working for peace. He was very much against wars, very much include finding racial harmony in our own country, overcoming our divisions, finding common ground. And he became much more involved. He went to more conferences about justice and peace, wrote a lot more about justice and peace. And really, the guilty bystander became a participant in the social justice causes of the time.
And then one of the things that you described his writing, and you've used this before, is that spiritual guides who speak most personally speak most universally.
Yeah.
Because he wrote and talked in very, the messiness of life he was comfortable with.
Great point. Yeah, I got that from Carl Rogers originally, who said, when I speak most personally, I speak most universally. And I've often used that. And Merton's an example of a confessional writer. That goes back to Augustine. Augustine was the first one who wrote spiritual autobiography in his Confessions. So he's telling us about his journey. And so Merton was that kind of writer. He's telling stories about his own spiritual growth, his own struggles, his own mistakes, his own oversights in what he was doing and thinking. So it's a confessional type of writing. So a lot of what he ended up publishing was his diaries that tell the story of his own spiritual growth. Yeah, confessional writer.
I have a book here called The Gracious Mystery. I think it was 1987 that you wrote. And in there you have a chapter on Merton, and you finish it with this. Thomas Merton speaks to us today not with the calm voice of assured answers, but with the sometimes anxious but always hopeful voice of the searching believer. Precisely for this reason, his words echo, affirm, and inspire.
I wrote that. That's pretty good.
It's really good.
You didn't make that
up. I highlighted it, and that's where I just read it here.
I think that's one of the first books I published, The Gracious Mystery. Yeah. Yeah, a lot of people still like that book after all these years. Yeah.
The affirm and inspire piece was, what did you mean by that?
Yeah. I think that when we take Merton seriously, we find him encouraging us to take seriously the opportunities we have in life. He wanted us to be grateful for the good things that happen. He wanted us to make up for our lacks and missteps and so on. He's encouraging us to be serious about the spiritual life and to remember we all are on a journey. And it's a very personal journey. So in one sense, that's going back to the original remarks I made about what we get out of him. So, yeah, and I mean, it's just odd that Merton is still popular. I mean, he's got nothing to do with the way people live their lives today. He's in a monastery. He's under control of his abbot. But he ends up, in a sense, he was fighting freedom and authority, right? So he had an authority, and how are you free in authority? In one sense, our young people can think that way. We could talk to my collegiate students when I was teaching them about that. That's something they understand. I mean, how are they going to distance themselves from their parents? How are they going to find their own way? How are they going to take the best of their parents and try to live that? Where do they seize ways in which maybe they think they could do better? So we're all can find a way in which we're involved in dealing with authority and freedom. That's, you know, a lot of the culture today talking about we have to have more freedom for. So in our culture, freedom's very much freedom from restraint, freedom from authority figures, freedom from government, freedom from everything. You know, the easy rider, he goes off on his motorcycle. But in Catholic spirituality, we like to talk more about freedom for. That is, that we are free to do things, to love our neighbor, and to work for justice and peace. And I think Merton affirms that, even though a totally different setting. I mean, our young people, the furthest thought in their mind is going to a monastery for the most part, although we still have that, which is interesting to me. We still have people wanting to do that sort of thing. But it's a human problem, freedom and authority. How do we best use our freedom? When have I let freedom just fall into license, just to do whatever I want to do my own thing? Merton was not much in favor of doing our own thing. You know, he's teaching us to be responsibly free and to use freedom to accomplish, to do things, to make the world a better place. I had a third thing. Do we have how much time do we have left?
I think we're fine. This is delve into the third factor.
In other words, I was saying there's a third way that I think he speaks to us today, and that is openness to interfaith dialogue. Mm. Now, a lot of Catholics in Vatican II mode and so on see the importance of ecumenical dialogue. We have to get along with our Protestant friends. They're with us. We all share so much in common with all our Lutheran and Methodist friends and so on. And we also share so much with our Jewish friends. But Merton opened up to the East, to the Eastern world. He became fascinated with it. He started dialoguing with D.T. Suzuki, a Zen Buddhist. And of all the Eastern branches of religion and spirituality, that's the one that interested Merton, Zen Buddhism. And even a larger Zen as a word for describing the emphasis on deep religious experience. So he liked to compare the Eastern Buddhist outlook with what a Christian mysticism. So we have a lot of Christian mystics, people who had deep religious experience, St. John of the Cross, for example, or Teresa of Avila. So we have a whole lot of Christian mystics, people who had these deep experiences that are unspeakable in a way. They couldn't describe them. They had to use metaphors. They had to use other language, new language. So he saw a great connection between our Christian mystics and Zen Buddhists. So he had this thing. He wrote a book called Zen and the Birds of Appetite. He had a lot of interesting titles. Zen and the Birds of Appetite, which reflects his dialogue with D.T. Suzuki and others, who we would actually contact or talk to or write letters back and forth and so on, became the basis of some of those books.
Some 50 published books?
So. Yeah, a lot, yeah. Yeah, there's no end to it. And there's all kind of, I've listened to some of it. He gave talks to the novices. Those are the people entering the monastery, just starting out, novices, beginners, and he often gave talks to them that are just brilliant. Mm. On remembering one on the American author Faulkner, it just had wide-ranging knowledge and interest and so on. So he gets invited to a conference going on in the Bangkok area, and somehow he got permission to go. I mean, I don't really understand how he managed that, but Dom Fox gave him permission to go to this conference. So he goes off, and he gets into Sri Lanka, and in Sri Lanka he finds a Buddhist shrine. As I got it, the Buddha's and the figure is carved out of the rock in this shrine. It's not so much a separate statue, but it's the Buddha figure is carved out of the rock. I've not ever seen it, so I'm going by descriptions I heard and so on. And it becomes one of the deepest religious experiences he had in his whole life. His whole life, he talks about it being lifted out of himself, of seeing reality in a new light, of understanding the oneness of the whole universe. I mean, it's just, I would say, one of the top religious experiences of his own life. One other one came to my mind. I mean, he had a lot of deep religious experience. One was he was in Havana, Cuba, and his father appeared to him. He had a fraught relationship with his father and so on, but his father was there in the room. And a lot of people who tell me they see their deceased loved ones, and I say, well, they're in good company. You know, in other words, I'm trying to verify their experience and validate their experience and say, well, Merton was convinced that his father was in the room with him in Havana, Cuba. And it made a big difference to him. So I'm talking about his religious experience. Now he's in the East. Okay, he's in the Eastern world. He was in Sri Lanka. He's going to end up at Bangkok, Thailand, at this conference. And he goes there and he's, you know, interacting with monks from all over the world, enjoying it all. He gave a wonderful talk that was well received, and he went back to his room to rest, and it was next to his bed was a fan, and he reached up to turn the fan on, and it fell on him and electrocuted him. Mm. Yeah, 1968.
Rough way to go.
Yeah, really, 1968. Hmm. He was born in 1915, so.
Pretty young.
He had a lot to give yet. Yeah. Think of the year 1968. Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy, the Democratic Convention in Chicago, and Merton's death in December of 1968. Hmm. So I'm wondering if my businessman friend who likes Merton will end up going to Bangkok or not to visit there, where they have remembrance of him dying there.
Obviously a powerful spiritual guide for many, many people. And
yeah, well, what he does in this last part that I'm saying, he opened us up to doing our own journey. He opened us up to being open to other religious traditions. Yep. And so we have a thriving Buddhist community in a lot of cities, and there are opportunities for that. I must say, just thinking of my own journey, I was lecturing in Japan, and there was by Lake Biwa, there was a monastery, and it was up the mountain. The only way you could get there was on a cable car. It was an arranged dialogue with the Buddhist monk for me, and got up there and met with the Buddhist monk, and he gets down on the floor and is showing me how to get the right posture for meditating and so on. It was fascinating to me, and I learned a lot. I also learned that he wasn't interested in talking metaphysics or theology or belief in God. If I asked that question, he would say he didn't understand the question. What he wanted to tell is how you breathe properly. And I couldn't find any way to get him to talk about who was he praying to or why was he praying or whatever. It was just he was into showing me how you should sit properly. And it was fascinating. But why did that come up? Well, it's probably what Merton does for many people. In other words, when he retells his own stories, he gets us to tell our stories. Which I just did, maybe exemplifying the point when I didn't realize it.
Sure. Summative statement about Thomas Merton. How do we wrap it up?
Good point. What I wanted to try to make sure we came up with some practical things where people would have takeaways. And I think that the best part that people would say, find your own way to pray. Find a routine. If it's, don't say you're going to do something 30 days in a row. Make it something you can do. Find a routine that you can do most of the time, whether the weather's good or bad, or whether you're in a good mood or bad mood. But at the end of the month, you wanted to do at least 20 times. Well, okay, do something like that. If you can't do 20, do 10. Find a routine. And then find the right place and the right time. And Thomas Merton could encourage us still, after all these years, to make the spiritual journey and make it more, with more meaning and purpose.
Amen. Thank you, Father Basin.